From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, math as a civil rights issue. We talk with Bob Moses. In 1964, he led Mississippi's Freedom Summer. Now he's opening opportunities for young African-American students with his innovative algebra project. Also today, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Lanford Wilson. His plays include Burn This, Tally's Folly, Bomb in Gilead, and Hot L Baltimore. His new play is in previews on Broadway. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg looks ahead to the end of the millennium. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Warren Christopher reiterated the Clinton administration's support for Boris Yeltsin today, calling the Russian president the one person who has the support of the people. Speaking in Chicago, Christopher said the United States welcomes Yeltsin's assurances that civil liberties will be respected. Yeltsin assumed dictatorial powers 3 days ago in a bid to sidestep his opponents in parliament and force a referendum on a new constitutional structure for Russia. While Christopher spoke, White House officials in Washington continued to offer support for Yeltsin, but indicated that the administration could work with other reformers in Russia. In his struggle with the Russian parliament, President Yeltsin took control of Russian state television and radio today. He said the move would ensure that journalistic freedoms are protected. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
Russian state television and radio are already under the control of the executive branch of government here, but yesterday, the Russian parliament condemned local TV's coverage of the events since Saturday, when Yeltsin announced he was assuming emergency powers. At the same time, the parliament has been planning to create new legislation that would strip the executive branch of responsibility for broadcasting and place it under the parliament's control. So in issuing his order today, Yeltsin is signaling that he intends to prevent any attempt on the part of the parliament to take over state television. Yeltsin is also ensuring he has direct access to the Russian people. Today he ordered the Interior Ministry to take the necessary measures to defend broadcasting facilities in the Russian capital. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
In Dearborn, Michigan today, members of the White House Task Force on Healthcare Reform met with citizens, business leaders, and healthcare workers. They discussed rising costs and the impact of reform on business. NPR's Patricia Naimond reports.
Labor leaders told this town meeting in Michigan that if healthcare costs aren't soon brought under control, then the nation can expect more and more strikes as unions fight to maintain their rich benefit packages. Business officials echoed the need to control costs. More companies are unable to provide benefits, they told the panel, leaving more and more Americans without insurance. Earlier today, citizens told distressing tales of being unable to buy insurance or receive adequate medical care. The Vice President's wife, Tipper Gore, and Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala sat in for Mrs. Clinton, who was in Little Rock with her sick father. The stories were familiar, said Secretary Shalala, and the message from America is getting through to the panel. Do something now to change the nation's troubled health care system. In Dearborn, Michigan, I'm Patricia Naimond reporting.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points to close at 3,465.48. Declines led advances by almost 2-1. This is NPR. The Serbian-dominated Yugoslav government charged today that Croatia is a major link in the smuggling of nuclear materials and technologies to the Middle East. The charges were contained in a note to the president of the UN Security Council from the Yugoslav Federation's UN representative. The note alleged that Croatia has helped in nuclear smuggling in exchange for arms and ammunition. The Yugoslav note charged that Croatia aided smugglers by providing safe storage and false documentation for illegal shipments. Federal negotiators have stepped up psychological warfare techniques in a bid to end the standoff with a religious sect in Waco, Texas. NPR's John Burnett reports.
In an effort to make life inside the religious compound even more unpleasant, the federal force near Waco, Texas began blaring loud music into the compound late last night. The tape was of chanting Laotian monks. The music, coupled with bright spotlights turned on the buildings, was a stern reaction to the cult not releasing as many people as federal agents had expected. 7 more Davidians walked out yesterday, bringing to 34 the number of cult members freed. FBI agent Bob Ricks denied they were allowing Koresh to play games with them.
We will take whatever action is necessary to get it resolved. And again, our ultimate goal from day one is to get it resolved peacefully.
Rick said federal officers would continue to turn up the pressure on the Davidians the longer they stay inside, although he would not elaborate on what additional measures would be taken. In Waco, I'm John Burnett.
Japan's ruling party is preparing an economic stimulus package aimed at helping the Japanese economy out of its recession. The program, estimated to cost a record $120 billion, is expected to include public works, expanded government loans, and tax breaks. The spending could also improve Japan's relations with its trading partners by increasing imports and cutting Japan's growing trade surplus. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bob Moses risked his life leading Mississippi's Freedom Summer in 1964. Hundreds of college students came to Mississippi that summer to help register black voters. 3 of the young activists, Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman, were murdered by white racists. What Moses is doing today doesn't have the drama of Freedom Summer, but he's convinced it will open up equally important opportunities. Moses is the head of the Algebra Project. His mission is to make young African Americans literate in math. Moses was a math teacher in New York before he joined the civil rights movement. For most of the 70s, he lived in Tanzania, where he taught math. His algebra project is being used in 12 cities, including Boston, where he's based. He recently returned to Mississippi to help bring the algebra project there. I asked Bob Moses how he's using algebra as a civil rights issue.
I think sort of the central issue is empowerment. And we're sort of dealing with that issue now with young children and their parents and the sort of communities of inner cities and rural areas around math. Whereas before, remember, with the right to vote, we were looking at empowerment around political participation, and it was sort of reading, writing, literacy, which was at the partially at the focus of that in terms of that participation. But so it's empowerment. That's the issue.
It seems to me like math literacy would be a difficult issue to organize around because a lot of young people think of themselves as not being very interested in math in the first place.
Actually, I think they think of themselves as not being good at math. And I think there's some interest in it if they feel that they could do it. And so one of the issues that we're confronting is, well, how do you get across to everybody, really, that everyone can do this subject, that it's a subject that is accessible to everyone? Math has been politicized, particularly algebra in our culture and school system, and we are accustomed to looking for people who have the math gene as opposed to saying, like we try to do with reading and writing, well, everybody needs to know how to read and write, and so we go out there to figure out how can we actually teach everybody to read and write. And what we're trying to say is that we need to do this with mathematics now.
Why algebra? Why has that been your focus?
Well, algebra has been the part that has been politicized. The school systems really have used algebra as a gatekeeper. They've used algebra as a subject to sort students. And schools, while they have the duty to sort students, there's nothing that says that algebra has to be the mechanism for doing that. And so what we've done now is said, well, algebra needs to be repoliticized. It needs to be used in a different way. We need to use it to pump students into a broad mathematical pipeline, so to speak. And so, I mean, algebra was self-selected, and so that's why we're looking at that particularly.
I'm interested in how you became an activist in the first place. I know you grew up in Harlem. You had gotten your master's in philosophy from Harvard.
right.
before going down to Mississippi in 1960.
Right.
Was there a particular incident that politicized you?
Well, it was the sit-ins. I was teaching at Horace Mann School in New York City. It's a private school right outside in Riverdale, outside of New York, and I was teaching math at the middle school level. And when the 60s, when the sit-ins broke in February, and I began reading and looking at the pictures in the New York Times, I felt like I had to go down and take a look firsthand at what was going on, because the people in the pictures, the students, the young black students, really look like I felt. I mean, I could feel in their looks what was going on inside me.
Could you describe what that feeling was?
Well, there's sort of a lot of repressed anger and resentment and a seething feeling that had been building up in me through high school and college and graduate school and watching the events of the 50s unfold. And what the students, I felt, were doing was they were getting directly at that.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so it was very powerful.
You know, I think there were two things. One, you were from the north going to the, from the urban north going to the rural south. Also, you were, you know, a Harvard grad. You were very educated, and you were going to a rural part of the country in which most of the people you were dealing with didn't have that kind of formal education.
Mm.
Did you feel like an outsider, and were you treated initially like an outsider who didn't quite get it?
I guess I didn't feel that way, and that certainly may have helped a lot for not being treated that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason I didn't feel that way is that my father and my family, we grew up in the Harlem River houses in New York City, which was a low-rent income project, but it turned out to be a little village. You know that saying, it takes a village to raise a child, that's that African proverb?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had a little village there at the Harlem River houses when I was growing up. This was in the 40s and the early 50s. And we had a community of adults and young children who worked together to provide really a nurturing environment for the youngsters growing up there. And so I grew up really with a very close base to working class, you know, average, you know, workers and people in Harlem. So I, although I knew about, you know, this other sort of higher type of society business, I was never really feeling like I was a part of that. And what happened was that I had very good mentors. I had Amzie Moore in Cleveland, Mississippi, who had lived there most of his life and who was the head of the NAACP there, and who was just a good organizer and also leader, and he played both roles.
How did you develop the focus for Mississippi Summer?
Well, the focus for Mississippi first really was developed through Amzie. Amzie looked at the students and the energy which they were carrying in the sit-in movement and said, they can really do something here in Mississippi if we take that energy and refocus it instead of on public accommodations, on voting and political rights. And so he mapped out the concept of a voter registration program for students to run, and I went down and really sort of brought it into reality with him and the other NAACP leaders who were left, Steptoe down in Amick County and CeCe Bryant down there in Macomb.
Did it make sense to you to focus on voter registration instead of integrating public facilities?
Yes, right. In fact, it was one of the things which was seething in me all during the 50s. Because you remember, after World War II, there was all this talk about the right to vote in Eastern Europe, and I just over and over again, and we were having the filibusters in the Senate and so forth, and I kept asking myself, Eastern Europe, sure, but what about people in this country? What about black folks?
How much of an issue was voting when you started in Mississippi? Was there already a popular movement?
There wasn't. No, what had happened in Mississippi through the 50s was a really strong repression. Mississippi was sort of our South Africa, and following the Supreme Court decision, the government of the state was really taken over by the racist organizations, so the White Citizens Councils, which were the respectable face of the Klan, really took over the state government. Ross Barnett was the governor, and he was really the tool of those groups. And so you had a really state-organized repression, and they really assassinated the NAACP leadership that they could. And so by the time we got there in 1960-61, there was a handful of leaders left. Medgar Evers was the state representative for the NAACP, and he was sort of operating a one-man shop there with a few leaders strung out across the state, and they were struggling to hold on. The national NAACP really would, its strategy was to work through the Mid-South and leave the Deep South for the end, so they were not putting a lot of resources into Mississippi at that time. And within the state, the strategy was, legal suits to try to break down the legal barriers.
What was the Supreme Court decision that you referred to?
1954, the Supreme Court decision around school desegregation. So that, you see, Mississippi just decided, well, they're not going to integrate the schools here, and the people who might try are the NAACP leadership with court cases, so they began killing off some of the leadership. It was Lee and Belzoni and Gus Quartz there, also in Belzoni. There was a whole string of them that went down during the 50s.
So you were operating in a climate of repression, intimidation, and violence.
Right.
What would you use, what would you do to convince people that it was worth the risk to try to register?
Well, I think people's backs were up against the wall, so there was a consensus that we all ought to try to register. And then, that it should be done. And then the question was, well, who are the people who are ready to step out? Now, one of the things was our accompanying them to the registration office. So in those areas where people felt more at home going down there, if we accompanied them, we did. And that's the registration office became the scene of little battles. In Walthall County, the sheriff pistol-whipped John Hardy when he brought some people in. And then in Amick County, they had some guys who came and jumped on me when I accompanied some people down to register in Liberty.
When you accompanied people to register to vote, on the occasions when they didn't beat you up and you got into the registrar's office, what were the typical obstacles that you'd face?
Well, the delaying tactics, so they would take one person at a time and, they would just drag it out. And then the people had to fill out some section of the Constitution and interpret it, so they would give them some very difficult passage to read and to write about. And then there would be some intimidations. Usually you would have law enforcement officers and highway patrolmen, sort of walking in and out. And then, so it would be a sort of intimidating atmosphere. And a lot of times then you would also have ordinary citizens coming in. And sometimes they would talk to people, to try to intimidate them.
What would you do to make it clear that you couldn't be intimidated? And especially when people are trying to intimidate others.
Well, mostly
others
we just kept coming back.
Right, right.
I guess that was the bottom line. That is that, okay, whatever you do, you know, you knock us down and we get back up and we come back. So that was basically it.
You were more educated, I'm sure, than the authorities who were standing in your way in Mississippi. Mm. Did you ever use that as a credential to intimidate them?
I didn't do a lot of talking, of course, and this is one of the issues, you know, because one of the first things is to let you know that you are not to talk, right? And I didn't really push that. I think here you're dealing with real personality, you know, dimensions, because I just, in my own way of reacting, I tended to sort of go into myself and find in myself some kind of core, which then I tried to project.
Now, that's the kind of thing that's sometimes interpreted as a sign of weakness?
I don't know. It depends, I guess. There's a way of sort of projecting how you feel in terms of confidence, mm-hmm, in just stillness, you know, so that you're not rattled.
Now, you said that the thing was not to talk. Why?
Well, the talking, the first thing about talking is whether you're going to say sir. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So that's the first line of battle. So as soon as you open your mouth, then they're going to want to say, you know, sir, you know, what did you say? Did you, you know, they want you to say sir to them. So you can hardly get a conversation off the ground.
My guest is Bob Moses. He led Mississippi's Freedom Summer in 1964. Now he heads the Algebra Project. We're after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Bob Moses is my guest. Were there tremendous acts of courage and cowardice that you witnessed in Mississippi?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of acts of courage. And some of them, you know, were small in one sense. There were a group of ladies when we were in jail in Macomb who took it upon themselves to deliver food to us every day. They cooked it themselves and they delivered it, and about 16 of us there in jail. And of course, in doing that, they were branded, right? And later, one of them had her house bombed. So there were a lot of those kind of things happening. And then, of course, there were people were murdered. Herbert Lee, Lewis Allen had a tremendous issue. He witnessed a murder, and Herbert Lee, who was one of the farmers working with us, got gunned down at the cotton gin there in Liberty, the same place where I had gotten beaten. And Lewis Allen saw it, and so the issue of testifying before the Justice of Peace, the jury that they pulled together there, and of giving his testimony to the federal government and the Justice Department, saying, well, there's no way we can give you any protection. And because of that, he suffered, you know, he got his jaw broken by one of the policemen down there. They put him in and out of jail over a couple of years, and finally they killed him. They drove up onto his front lawn one day and you know, blasted him away. And he sort of lived that really on his own for over a couple of years, because Herbert Lee was killed in 61. And Lewis Allen was shot down in the beginning of 64, and it was really his death which really turned the corner about having the Mississippi Freedom Summer. It's like we had come full circle, and we weren't able to do anything in response to Herbert Lee's murders, but we were in position to do something when Lewis Allen was gunned down.
When people were murdered in Mississippi, people in the civil rights movement from Mississippi, or people from outside who'd come down to work there, like Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, was it a personal crisis for you, too?
Yeah. Herbert Lee was the first person that we were working with very closely who was murdered, and that was in the first summer when we went down. And I guess the only way in which we could sort of live through it was to say, well, we are going to live our lives and go through the same kind of danger that led to his being murdered. And so we're not asking other people to do what we are not also daily doing. And that's how, from my point of view, I got through it.
Has the sense of responsibility that you may have felt when people were killed in Mississippi stayed with you over the years?
Well, there's a sense of responsibility, but there's the sense of, I guess, that you were in a war, really. Mississippi was a war zone, and we may have made some mistakes, but we didn't try to tag mistakes to murders, right? So what I guess we said was that we all were exposed to the same dangers, and on balance, a job was like damned if you do and damned if you don't, and we got through it in some way. I mean, what you can say is that Mississippi became a part of the United States. It became a state like other states. It was no longer a law unto itself. It was no longer our apartheid situation. And in getting through it, we felt like we did something, you know, that, and blood had to, it was clear that blood was going to be shed. It was being shed before we got there. I don't think anyone was thinking that we would get through it without more blood being shed.
Bob Moses led Mississippi's Freedom Summer in 1964. Since 1982, he's directed the Algebra Project. He's based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Lanford Wilson, one of the playwrights who helped to create Off-Off-Broadway in the 1960s. Since then, he's made it to Broadway and won a Pulitzer Prize. His plays include Bomb in Gilead, Burn This, Tally's Folly, and Hotel Baltimore. His new play is previewing on Broadway. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg looks ahead to the 21st century and prepares for a letdown. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There was praise today for Russia's embattled President Boris Yeltsin from Secretary of State Warren Christopher. In a major address in Chicago, the Secretary built a case for increased Western aid to help Yeltsin implement political and economic reforms. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Bringing Russia into the family of nations is the greatest strategic challenge of our time, Christopher said, arguing for more, better targeted Western aid. If Russia lurches back to despotism, he warned, the West will face a renewed nuclear threat, higher defense budgets, and spreading instability. Secretary Christopher supported Yeltsin's call for national elections in April to resolve his current power struggle with the Russian parliament.
In doing so, he has again demonstrated his faith that the only force that can guarantee reform is the people, the Russian people.
The most important point is that Russia remain a democracy during this period, Christopher said, adding, this is the only basis for the U.S.-Russian partnership. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Also in Washington, the White House has announced that President Clinton will hold a news conference tomorrow afternoon, his first formal news conference since taking office. A spokeswoman says there is no reason for the meeting with reporters, that it just seemed like a good opportunity. Mr. Clinton is sure to face questions about the situation in Moscow. The president spent the last 2 days in Little Rock, where his father-in-law suffered a stroke last Friday. Pressure is mounting in Israel for action to stop Arab-Israeli violence. A Palestinian is accused of stabbing 5 Israeli students and a high school principal in Jerusalem today. And Israeli soldiers reportedly killed 3 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. From Jerusalem, NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The Palestinian attacker came from a village just outside Jerusalem, and his family said he attacked the Israelis for religious reasons. The man walked into the courtyard of the high school and began stabbing students with a kitchen knife. The principal fell on the 22-year-old Palestinian and stopped him. Following the incident, angry Jews stoned Arab cars, breaking several windshields. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin rejected calls for a further crackdown on Palestinians, saying it is impossible to seal off the occupied territories from Israel. He also said that Israel will fight terrorism as if there were no peace process and pursue the peace process as if there were no terrorism. He called on Israelis to channel their anger into something constructive, such as joining neighborhood safety patrols. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 8 points to close at 3,465.48 on volume of more than 232 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 2-1. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, UN officials say a tank battle is taking place in the outskirts of Sarajevo as fighting continues around the capital. Local news reports say 18 children were injured and one was killed when a school was hit by a shell. Fierce fighting has also closed the main road to the airport. According to news reports, it appears that Serbian factions have made advances, allowing them to direct fire on the western approaches to the city, making it difficult to get supplies to Bosnian factions. At the UN, Bosnian peace talks appear on the verge of collapsing because of differences over a plan to divide the nation into 10 provinces. Also in New York City, the UN Security Council met behind closed doors to talk about a plan for taking over security operations in Somalia, now being conducted by a U.S.-led force. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
Council members have been putting the finishing touches on a draft resolution. The plan, recommended by Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, sets a transition date of May 1st. It calls for a 28,000-strong peacekeeping force, which would have military enforcement powers. But concern over a one-year cost, estimated at $1.5 billion, is likely to result in a shorter six-month mandate instead. After the transition, the U.S. is expected to keep 3,000 to 5,000 soldiers there to provide logistical support for the U.N. force. The mission is to disarm the warring factions and ensure delivery of humanitarian relief. Diplomats say a resolution could be adopted as early as Tuesday. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
Secretary of Defense Les Aspin is back at work 4 days after getting a heart pacemaker. A spokesman says the secretary's day began with a meeting with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and members of his policymaking group. Aspin got out of the hospital Saturday, saying he felt all right. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest Lanford Wilson is one of the playwrights who created the off-off Broadway scene in the 60s. His work was so popular it ended up on Broadway. John Malkovich starred in the Broadway production of Wilson's Burn This. Wilson won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1980 play Tally's Folly, one in a series of plays about the Tally family of Lebanon, Missouri, Wilson's hometown. Critic Clive Barnes described the Tally family as having become part of the legend of American theater. Wilson's other plays include Bomb in Gilead and Hot El Baltimore, which set a performance record for off-Broadway theater and became the basis for a TV series of the same name. Wilson is still a member of the Circle Repertory Theater, which he co-founded in 1969 with Marshall Mason. Mason is the director of Wilson's new play, Redwood Curtain, about a 17-year-old Amerasian girl who goes in search of her father. Redwood Curtain opens next week on Broadway and is now in previews. I spoke with Wilson last March during a pre-Broadway run in Philadelphia. I asked him what the vision was for the Circle Rep when he and Mason started it in 1969.
Frankly, we wanted to become the Great American Theater, the Great American Theater Company. But we had done a number of plays. The group, even before we were founded, Marshall and I and Rob Thurkiel and Tanya, we'd done a number of plays that had large casts and ensemble acting that just took forever to rehearse and forever to get right. And in order to create an ensemble, you have to totally trust everyone else on stage with you, because otherwise you're going to make a very large choice and the actor is going to leave you hanging out there. I've seen actors on stage actually look at the audience like, what in the hell was that all about, when someone makes this huge, enormous choice. Well, so the actor, you have to trust that person to be there for you. And if that person is there for you, you can make deeper choices, and that person can make deeper choices. And it just, you can just create a much fuller, farther out, more profound experience. And that can only happen in ensemble, or if you happen to know the actor very well, or if you happen to be directed right. And so we wanted to create an ensemble, that kind of an ensemble that would take chances, and would not leave the other person hanging out there. The idea was to do a combination. We're not doing classics now, but for years we did. We'd do two classics and three original plays each year, because we wanted to train the actors to do classics and then have that instrument, that classical instrument, available to contemporary writers. In other words, the best actors we could get. And the contemporary writers would teach the actors how to act, and the classics which would elevate them, and it was to be hoped that that the writers would also be stimulated by the classics.
Was it your ambition to get to Broadway, or had you given up on Broadway?
Given up on it completely. We really had no interest in Broadway at all. I think maybe distantly in our mind, there was probably a 399 seat house somewhere in the village, where we would end up as our permanent home, but not a Broadway house, because we wanted to do a number of plays a year instead of running something for a commercial run. Nothing had transferred then. Nothing had, when we formed the theater, there wasn't the movement that there is now of plays from regional theaters to Broadway and from off-Broadway to off-Broadway and off-Broadway to Broadway. Things weren't doing that. So it never crossed our mind that we could, that if we had something that was a commercial hit, that we could move it to Broadway.
One of your early successes was Hotel Baltimore. And this was about people in a hotel that's condemned.
Yes.
And in your early days in New York, you lived in welfare hotels, right?
Right. I first lived at a place that I never did learn the name of it. I think the hotel did not have a name.
Was it called Hotel?
it should have been. It was right across the street from Manhattan Hotel. And they answered the phone with something incomprehensible. I never did hear what it was. It sounded sort of like Hevro. And so we called it the Hevro Hilton. But it was definitely a welfare hotel. And then I moved from there down to the Broadway Central. And the week I moved out of the Broadway Central, the hotel collapsed.
Wow.
It fell completely into the ground. Fortunately, it did it slowly. It did it over a period of about a day and a half, so everyone got out. But I had a lot of experience with that kind of hotel.
Did you lay awake often at night overhearing fights that were happening in the halls or in other rooms?
Like that scene in the movie Big? I just saw the movie Big on television last night. When I slept was the hours that I didn't go to sleep until about 8 in the morning back then. And so I had a nice quiet sleep. I was part of the people that was making the noise so other people couldn't sleep, probably.
What were you doing all night?
Well, I was writing, and the whole neighborhood was it was the middle of Needle Park. It was such an enormous shock to me and so thrilling because the neighborhood was filled with hustlers and pimps and prostitutes and drag queens. I'd never seen anything like it in my life.
Not everybody would find that thrilling.
Well, it was thrilling to me. I thought it was the most colorful place I'd ever seen in my life. Also, there were a bunch of guys from Columbia, so I was learning Spanish,
Not Columbia University.
Didn't learn, not from Columbia University. From Columbia in Costa Rica. So I just found it thrilling. I would walk right up to a pusher and say, "How exactly does a drug transition work? And where do you get the dope from?" And they'd say, "Get out of here, kid." Because I just wanted to know how everything worked. I thought it was really exciting. So I was usually downstairs this is all Baum and Gilead. I was usually downstairs with the Baum and Gilead crowd in that coffee shop.
Yeah, let me explain that Baum and Gilead is a play that takes place in an all-night diner.
An all-night diner,
it's a diner that's frequented mostly by drug dealers and pimps and prostitutes and other small-time criminals.
Yeah.
So what attracted you to people like that? You were from the Midwest?
Yeah, from a very proper upbringing in the Midwest. Grew up on a farm. What did attract me to? I think it was raw enterprise that attracted me. Everyone was out to make a buck, which is true of everyone everywhere. But it was just so raw and bold and obvious there that when I was writing Baum and Gilead, I always said I could really be writing about Wall Street. It would be exactly the same, and that's why I was trying. I was looking at the economics of it. Also, they had such a great sense of humor about themselves. There were at least five. There was a drag queen and a drug dealer and a fantastic prostitute who just would sit around dishing the dirt, and it was the funniest dialogue I'd ever heard in my life. I didn't ever get the prostitute into a play until I wrote Hotel Baltimore, and then finally the part that Concetta Ferro played, April Green. Finally, I got that prostitute into it. You couldn't say a word to that woman without a comeback.
So what did all the hustlers and con men and drug dealers bring out in you? What surfaced in you?
Oh, I was their pet. I mean, they knew I was writing down every word they said because I would walk up and say, "Would you repeat that, please?" And they thought I was the cutest thing they'd ever seen. You know, they thought I was really very silly. You know, they kind of protected me. I think they felt very protective. When I finished the play, Baum and Gilead, I gave it to a couple of people I'd written about, like an idiot, to read and check for errors. And they read it and said, "Well, that's more or less what it's like."
My guest is Lanford Wilson. His new play, Redwood Curtain, opens next week on Broadway. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. I guess it's playwright Lanford Wilson. Well, after plays like Baum and Gilead and Hot Old Baltimore, you eventually turned to completely different subject matter, which was a family from the Midwest, the Tally series of
plays. The Tally series, right.
It's a family from the Midwest, from Lebanon, Missouri, which I think is where you're originally from.
Yeah, I was born in Lebanon.
Yeah, so this is a family that's not your family, but not probably
not,
unlike...
Not at all my family.
Okay, yeah, but your family must have some connection to them. So how did you turn from this family that was very exotic, very not like you at all, you know, the Baum and Gilead crew,
right,
turn from that to a Midwestern family who absorbed you for five plays?
Yeah, I think they were kind of exotic to me. My connection with that family is my mother cleaned for them.
Oh.
So they were sort of, these were the rich people that lived up on the hill, and they were exotic to me. I had always wanted to write about them. I had spent hours talking to various members of this family and other people like that. So the whole class, I'd go with my mother and she would clean the house, and I would talk to the cook and the lady of the house and the kids that live there. So I always was very strongly attracted to all of those rich kids because we were very poor, and examined them. I mean, you know, I would, on the rare times when I went to their houses, you know, I would ask the mother to take me through the house so I could see the way they lived. It was fascinating to me.
Explain what it was about the Tally family that you created, the family that was originally loosely based on the family that your mother cleaned for. I mean, what absorbed you in that family enough to bring you back about five different times?
I think they were America for me. I think they were changing so much. The war had had a very profound effect on them. The country was changing, and they were changing, and were not coping particularly well with the change. And that, I think, was the first thing that drew me to them. The whole idea of a family is very interesting to me because it's not at all the way the politicians talk about. We have to create a strong family unit, and everything is for the family. Well, bull hockey. I mean, families are about the most destructive things that's ever been invented. They're horrible. And there are so few families that work. Half the families and half the people in the country don't have two parents. You could name on one hand anyone in a class of, say, 60 that has one meal with the entire family sitting down together. That doesn't happen anymore. I wonder if it ever did. And also the meals that we had at home were the most horrible experiences of my life.
What kind of food?
Well,
it wasn't the company, as
my stepfather telling us all how to eat, and you know, and it was his only chance to torture the family altogether, and so he made the most of it.
Do you ever worry about off-Broadway dying, in part because of cable and television?
No, not because of television. I worry about it dying because... I don't really, because I think there's always new blood coming into mm-hmm. it. But there's always new people coming to town that want to put on a show, or they want the experience, and they're going to find an off-Broadway somewhere to do that. And if they don't do it in New York, they'll do it in Chicago. Well, they're doing it in Chicago. They'll do it in Seattle, and they're doing it in Seattle. They'll do it in San Francisco, and they're doing it there in L.A. And probably Atlanta as well, and a number of other places. It's happening all across the country. They're now off-Broadway, and off-Broadway is in Seattle and San Francisco. So really, when you're asking, do you worry about off-Broadway dying, it's do you worry about new plays coming up and that energy dying? And I don't, because I think it's going to be happening somewhere, because there's always going to be people who need to write plays. It's just a completely different experience from going to a movie or from writing for the movies. There's always going to be people who are interested in the literature of the theater.
Lanford Wilson, his new play, Redwood Curtain, opens on Broadway next week at the Brooks Atkinson Theater. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have from Moscow?
Hi, Terry. Mike Schuster reports from Moscow about the efforts of the Constitutional Court there to figure out if Boris Yeltsin's Take Charge decree is indeed unconstitutional. I'll talk with a Muscovite who still supports Mr. Yeltsin. She is fearful of a return to communism, and she says that would mean an end to disarmament, for example. Also, we'll talk with Nancy Griffith about her new album, Other Voices, Other Rooms, a tribute to great folk song writing, Woody Guthrie, Malvina Reynolds, Bob Dylan, also some new traditional folk song writers like Frank Christian and Townes Van Zandt. And we'll hear the complete version of Tecumseh Valley by Townes Van Zandt.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts about how we talk about the approaching millennium. Evocations of the year 2000 have shown up in advertisements, book titles, and a presidential inaugural address.
And so, my fellow Americans, as we stand at the edge of the 21st century, let us begin anew with energy and hope, with faith and discipline, and let us work until our work is done.
You could see why Clinton made a reference to the turn of the century in his inaugural speech. He's got to be thinking that if he plays his cards right, his work may not be done until the year 2000. The year 2000. For people born before mid-century, that used to be a phrase to conjure with. By the year 2000, we'd all be flying to work with our personal jetpacks. Or we'd all be telecommuting to work from our home computers. Or we wouldn't have to work at all. But as the hour draws near, the date seems to have lost some of its magic. I read in the New York Times that by the year 2000, the United States will need 22% more accountants and auditors. Carbon emissions will be reduced by 5%, and the European community will end most of its agricultural subsidies. About the only person who was willing to go out on a limb was a Department of Transportation spokesperson who said that by the year 2000, Amtrak would be self-sufficient. It seems a matter-of-fact greeting for the end of a millennium, particularly when you contrast it with the last time this milestone was passed. In the late 900s, all of Europe was nervously expecting the imminent end of the world and the coming of the Antichrist. Of course, a millennium is a big chunk of time for the modern secular consciousness to grasp. But even the end of the century no longer seems to have much of a hold on the imagination. We don't even have a name for the period we're living through. This is simply the 90s, which will be followed by the aughts or the noughts or the zeros or whatever. But by the last decade of the 19th century, people were already conscious of themselves as living at the fin de siècle. In many ways, that age was strikingly like our own. Self-proclaimed decadents were busy denouncing bourgeois morality. Bourgeois moralists were fulminating about the decay of traditional values. There was widespread anxiety about the social effects of technology, alongside of popular manias for new inventions like the bicycle. It was a time of increasing crime and drug use, of economic crises and political scandals, of feminist agitation, and of disturbing new nationalisms. What's different is that a century ago, people had a vivid sense of living in history at a time of astonishing changes. The 19th century came in as the age of Beethoven, Blake, and Napoleon. By the time it was over, the world knew about communism and anarchism, pointillism and feminism, telephones, automobiles, and the cinema, submarines, and poison gas. And change seemed to accelerate over the following half century as the world of life with father yielded to the world of father knows best. And then things seemed to slow down. What's striking about watching all those 50s sitcoms on TV is how very little the material conditions of life have changed since then. Of course, now there are microchips in the refrigerator and all sorts of wonderful new things in the medicine chest. But people are still driving to work, still eating frozen pizza, still talking on the telephone, and still watching sitcoms on TV. Around the turn of the century, the poet Charles Peguy wrote that the world had changed more in the past 30 years than in all the preceding ages back to the time of Jesus Christ. That was probably an overstatement, but it's hard to imagine anyone now saying the same thing about the 30 years since the Johnson administration. Never mind whether Amtrak will actually be making money by the turn of the century, who 50 years ago would have thought that there would even be any trains left by now? But it isn't that history has stopped flowing, only that we seem to have forgotten that we're swimming in it. The first casualty is the future. The last fin de siècle was the age of the great utopian fictions of writers like William Morris, H.G. Wells, and Edward Bellamy, depictions of bright futures of material plenty and social justice. Whereas what we get now are cyberpunk visions of worlds that look pretty much like the present, except that the streets are dirtier and it's always raining. Even the word futuristic has become démodé, with its quaint connotations of Noguchi coffee tables, the Studebaker Avanti, and Star Trek, the rerun. The future ended in 1965 when the Flushing World's Fair closed down. That's what it means to live in the postmodern condition. Nobody knows what time it is anymore.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Curtis Mayfield. He wrote and sang such soul classics as People Get Ready, Keep on Pushing, I'm So Proud, and the songs for the film Superfly. A recent stage accident left him paralyzed from the neck down. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.